Hi, this is Tim from Stereolab, and you're listening to Noise of Carpet on CJSF 90.1 and CJSF.ca.
Awesome. Thanks, Tim.
Hi, I'm Andre Goulet. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase. Harbinger Showcase is a weekly podcast syndicated to community and campus radio, including CITR, CJSR, and Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Victoria's CFUV, CIVL in Abbotsford, ZKUW and CJUM in Winnipeg, at Met Radio in Toronto, at Radio Laurier in Waterloo, at CFMU in Hamilton, at CJM in Windsor, at Montreal CKUT, and at CJBU in Sydney, Nova Scotia, and featuring highlights from the country's favorite progressive podcast community. Since launching in 2020, the Harbinger Media Network's become Canada's number one listener-supported nonprofit podcast network, featuring 83 shows exploring politics, society, and culture from progressive perspective. Find out more about the community and subscribe to our weekly newsletter at harbingermedianetwork.com. On this episode, we unpack Carney's cringe Path to Pipeline MOU between Alberta and the feds on Bubble Pop. Look back on the impact of the LEAP manifesto at the federal NDP's 2016 convention in Edmonton on the Progress Report, and discuss how decades of Canadian mining interests and weapons smuggling has made us complicit on the war in Sudan on the Breach Show. But first, this episode of Harbinger Showcase is brought to you by Canada's progressive journalism community, Unrigged. Launched in 2023 as a response to Meta's Canadian news ban, Unrigged.ca is a one-stop website aggregating and updating new journalism on the hour, including podcasts, videos, newsletters, and in-depth reporting from publishers like Briar Patch in Regina, The Grind in Toronto, The Independent in St. John's, and national publications like Press Progress, The Breach, The Maple, and 24 more. Bookmark the site and make it your daily destination for Canadian news at unrigged.ca. This episode of Harbinger Showcase is also brought to you by the Alberta Advantage. Based in Calgary, this collection of more than 20 activists, academics, and journalists have been broadcasting award-winning political commentary, news, and analysis since 2017. On this excerpt from a new episode, the team look at what Mark Carney's 2025 budget contains in a conversation asking how the nation-building rhetoric the Prime Minister campaigned on could actually have been implemented. Now, here's the show. Makes no
difference. The Alberta Advantage is a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network. This independent, listener-supported podcast is possible thanks to listeners like you. If you think what we do is important, support us with a monthly donation at patreon.com/albertaadvantage.
Hello, and welcome to the Alberta Advantage. I'm your host, William, and joining Team Advantage today is our Lower Canada correspondent, Liam.
Bonjour.
And Dave.
Hello.
So the Liberal federal government of Mark Carney just dropped its first budget on November 4th, and it's not great. The feds have been signaling since the summer that it was going to be an austerity budget, saying the government needed to spend less and invest more. At the beginning of July, letters were sent by the finance minister, François-Philippe Champagne. So these letters were sent to the various federal departments asking them to find 7.5% in spending reductions for the next fiscal year starting in April 2026. Then, says Mr. Champagne, another 10% for 2027 to 2028 and 15% for 2028 to 2029. So major public sector job losses were also to be expected, which will have a knock-on effect with service frequency and quality. Interestingly, the Carney government has not shied away from calling this austerity, rather than hiding behind the usual euphemisms of efficiencies and savings. And this budget has been hyped as the most consequential one since 1995, when a previous Liberal government slashed and burned public services, which did lasting damage to this country. Many people might be surprised by Carney's austerity posturing, as during the spring election campaign, the Grit's messaging had much more positive tone about public spending as part of elbows up. So let's quote from the Canada Strong election platform, which incidentally is also the name of the budget. And we find rhetoric like, quote, invest in nation-building infrastructure on a scale not seen in generations, unquote. Quote, enshrine and protect CBC Radio Canada by introducing legislation to establish statutory funding, unquote. Quote, it used to be that the federal government built housing that our growing population needed. So we're going to get back into the business of building houses. We will use every tool at our disposal, leveraging technology and innovation to build homes at a scale and a speed not seen since the Second World War, unquote. This wasn't all vague vibes. There were hard numbers, like the CBC receiving an extra $150 million annually, or a federal crown corporation directly building homes, although that has turned out to be more subsidies to private developers who profit off the housing crisis. Making these ambitious proposals for federal intervention helped the Liberals win another term, as Canadians were spooked by the unpredictability of the obviously rotting empire to our south. So given all this talk from Carney and Champagne that Canada faces a national crisis in a time of significant global uncertainty, it seems rather stupid to order the largest haircut of federal state capacity in 30 years.
However, with the budget now out, is it liberal austerity too? In terms of decreasing overall federal spending, not exactly, but there are $60 billion in cuts to operational spending over 5 years, workforce reductions of 40,000, shrinking the public service by over 10%. There is quite a bit of new spending, $141 billion worth over the next 5 years, but this is mostly focused on capital infrastructure, fossil fuels, as we'll get to later, and indeed the military. If you only read the headlines, you'll also think that the most important number to Canadian pundits, especially those in places like the National Post, that the projected first annual deficit for this budget is $78 billion. Indeed, we think that the austerity singling was probably a messaging tactic so that the Grits could deliver something less severe and call it a positive. Spending less to invest more is the slogan of this budget, and it does capture what the budget intends to do. And there's plenty of spin there that needs to be interrogated. And we'll do that in the course of this episode. But the cuts are very real. The investments, perhaps less so. When examining Minister Champagne's budget, we approach it with some broad questions about its sloganeering. The budget's framed as making sacrifices, but who's going to make them? The budget promises more investment, but who's actually going to collect the return? So in this episode, we're going to go through a bit of the history of austerity budgets in this country, specifically the 1995 federal one, before talking about the current budget and laying out some alternative visions for public finances. In short, our argument is that the allocation of public money is hardly a neutral result of the balance sheet, but instead politically contested about who should benefit from state action. In particular, fiscal austerity is a class project to direct public resources upwards at the expense of working people. It's elbows up, except we're not all playing on the same team.
In March of this year, the Fraser Institute put out a study celebrating the 30th anniversary of the 1995 federal budget. And, you know, we're always going to listen when the Fraser Institute puts out a study. They called it one of the most important in Canadian history. But now Canada is repeating mistakes of the past and is on a similar fiscal trajectory as it was prior to the 1995 budget, they say. And if something is being toasted by a bunch of corporate dark money funded think tankers, you know, it's absolute dog shit. So in February 1995, the federal Liberal government of Jean Chrétien introduced an undeniably historically important budget. Finance minister and former shipping magnate Paul Martin helmed this assault of public finances, and the 1995 budget is basically the model of modern austerity budget in this country. Quoting the budget itself, quote, "The objective is to get government right, so that it can fulfill its social and economic mandates more effectively and sustainably. This will include deep cuts in the level of federal program spending, not simply lower spending growth, but a substantial reduction in actual dollars spent," unquote. So that budget pretty baldly stated it was an austerity one. So let's run through some of these things, and we did cover this in an episode in 2020. So the budget took $25 billion and 45,000 jobs out of the government sector over a three-year period. Federal spending was to be rolled back 40 years relative to the size of the economy. It cut infrastructure program spending in half. It canceled the promised child care program, which they'd only just put in place. And provinces would still be left to go their own way on social assistance, post-secondary education, and healthcare. And this downloading of our responsibility for these things to the provinces is like behind everything wrong at the provincial level across the country today. Federal government withdrawing from economic and political responsibility for social programs, particularly housing, has been absolutely awful. And we can see that in the state of the housing market today in Canada. The only growth in spending was in interest payments on debt, jumping by $9 billion to $51 billion in 1996-97. So expectations of high real interest rates, slowing growth, and high unemployment. David Frum, who was then a future war criminal, said the budget, quote, ripped the guts out of liberalism as a governing political idea in Canada. Pretty much everything accomplished by the Liberal Party between 1968 and 1984 now stands condemned. Papers ran lots of positive stories about the budget, including a Calgary Herald story featuring a quote-unquote middle-class Calgary family, the Calverts, who had an income of $120,000. This is the 90s. Median family income was $45,000 at the time, so they had almost triple the average income. We've had the benefits of Canada, they say. Now is the time for our generation to suffer a bit, unquote.
Chrétien didn't suffer in popularity in polling after this budget. It actually remained still pretty high. There was a masterful propaganda campaign which outgunned any potential criticism. A study of Canadian Press Wire Service over that year found that the Fraser Institute and the Howe, C.D. Howe Institute, were quoted in 140 news stories in favor of all these cuts, while the Canadian Center for Policy Alternatives, which is a more progressive think tank, was quoted only 16 times. Federal fiscal transfers to the provinces to underwrite their welfare programs were savagely attacked as a source of savings. Health and education programs in particular were made possible by federal provincial cost sharing in the past, but then that was cut. Paul Martin's Canada Health and Social Transfer Program combined all these previous transfers to the provinces for health, education, and social assistance into a single smaller block grant that would take effect April 1st, 1996. In 1996, it was worth $26.9 billion, $2.8 billion less than the $29.7 billion in transfers the year prior. Part of this credit was in tax points, which meaning that the feds reduced their income tax rate in a province by a set amount, allowing the provincial government to raise theirs by the equivalent, which many did not do. So in terms of actual cash transfers by 1997, it was only $10.3 billion. This represents a 40% cut in federal funding over 2 years, and then it shrank further over subsequent years. Only the unconditional equalization transfer was not directly affected by the Martin budget, I guess small mercies. In the first two Martin budgets, he cut what was then called unemployment insurance program by $3.5 billion per year beginning in 1996, which is about one-fifth of the $16 billion the UI fund paid out in 1994. Social Security reform here meant a 10% reduction overall and a transfer of money from areas that create dependence, quote, into, quote, investments in people which make them more employable, unquote. They also examined reductions in UI premiums for employers, which was, you know, cutting the payroll tax, essentially. And statistics show that people were drawing on UI more frequently because employers were no longer creating full-time permanent jobs, instead relying on a pool of contingent workers. But the government made UI much more difficult to access. By 1998, fewer than 39% of people paying into UI received benefits when they became unemployed, which was down from 87% in 1990. So the UI fund would start generating a huge surplus since it wasn't paying out nearly as much as it was taking in. And Paul Martin used those surpluses in the late 90s and early 2000s to put more sums into general revenue. Basically, he used money intended to help unemployed people, which workers and employers had paid into for years, to instead make his budgets balance. By 2000, Paul Martin's finance ministry had pocketed nearly $40 billion from the UI fund. The budget also accelerated rural depopulation. They ended a lot of regional development programs. So basically, the end of any attempt to have a sense of sort of even development across this country. My region, where I grew up, Cape Breton Island, was deeply impacted by these cuts to regional development programs. And in the 5 years after the 1995 budget, 7% of the island's population moved away to find work. So that's like 10,000 people. The mid-1990s was also a period of high unemployment. as federal cuts were matched by a tightened monetary policy from the Bank of Canada to tackle supposed runaway inflation. The national jobless rate was 10.1% in 1996. And these federal cuts happened alongside and often spurred provincial cuts to their welfare programs. So you can see a very measurable increase in poverty across the country. For example, visible homelessness was largely not a phenomenon in this country before the 1980s, but federal cuts to housing supports and mental health really created this problem. And in general, federal housing investments were rolled back, so many of us have to pay obscene amounts of money of our incomes to be housed. And home ownership as it stands is largely out of reach of many younger generations. And now the Liberals, or at least the Liberals, were indicating that we should do this again 30 years later.
Does the Alberta Advantage? Find out more about the show at albertaadvantagepod.com and hear the rest of the conversation at harbingermedianetwork.com. You listen to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. I'm Harbinger Director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Coming up next. Every week since February 2025, your least favorite person's least favorite journalist, Rachel Gilmore, breaks down the main headlines so you don't have to doom scroll on Bubble Pop. On this highlight from a new episode, Rachel sits down with BC Green Party leader Emily Lowen and activist and Calgary drag superstar Karla Marx to unpack why Carney's Path to Pipeline MOU between Alberta and the feds just keeps getting worse the more that you look at it. Now, here's the show.
Hello, I'm Rachel Gilmore, your least favorite person's least favorite journalist. Welcome to Bubble Pop. This is the weekly show where we talk about some of the biggest headlines and juiciest news tidbits so you don't have to doom scroll. And you guys know the drill by now. We're doing it live for season two. So if you guys want to support the show, as usual, you can subscribe on Patreon, Substack, YouTube, and anywhere you like to listen. And just a reminder that I'm going to try to leave about 10 minutes at the end of the episode for live chat questions. You can leave those in the chat using the super chat function on YouTube. But also, I'll just try to take some general questions. So don't be shy if you still want to ask one and don't feel like using the super chat. Today, there is a lot to talk about. The Alberta government just signed a memorandum of understanding with the federal government that lays out the conditions for a new oil pipeline. Awesome. Well, it's very unlikely that this pipeline will come to be, given Coastal First Nations and BC aren't too keen on it, to put things lightly. And it also needs a private proponent. Carney does seem to be trying to de-risk the idea of a pipeline for a potential private investor, including telling them that he'd be willing to, quote, adjust the tanker ban off the coast of BC, which protects those waters from oil spills. Overall, he's managed to piss off Coastal First Nations, BC, the Bloc Québécois, the Green Party, and one of his own cabinet ministers who just resigned from cabinet, all to placate Alberta, the same province that is addicted to invoking the notwithstanding clause, primarily using it to trample on the rights of trans kids. Yeah, I said we got a lot to talk about, didn't I? Luckily, we've got some great guests on the show today to help me do it. In just a few seconds, we'll be joined by Dr. Victoria Buchholz. I practiced that, a.k.a. Karla Marx. She is the Alberta organizer for the 2SLGBTQ plus rights group Queer Momentum. We're also getting ready to see a recent guest all over again, which is super nice of her to be so generous with her time. BC Green Party leader Emily Lowen is a climate activist and organizer and the first Gen Zer to lead an official party in Canada. Emily, Victoria, welcome to Bubble Pop.
It's great to be back so soon.
I so appreciate it. Okay, the first thing I have to ask you, Emily, who did you think you were saying f- online? Like, how, that was just unbelievable.
How dare I, frankly?
Yeah, really? I mean, it's not like the situation merits it, right?
No, you know, all these old men in their armchairs are, you know, getting up with banging fists. I think, you know, it was well worth it. But, you know, Andrew Weaver, he's just mad that everyone he's politically backed since he left office has lost. Like, I don't know. There seems to be some grudge happening there. And yeah, he was, you know, also openly angry that I won this leadership race, and said that he felt politically homeless now, despite having backed, you know, the conservative leader John Rustad and other political parties since. So, you know, let's not pay attention to that guy. We can get him back to bed.
Oh my God, that's funny. Okay, so putting him to bed, let's focus on what actually made you say, what the hell is going on with this pipeline deal? I want both of your reaction. Emily, since I'm already talking to you, I'll let you go first. And then Carla, I'm bringing you in here.
This is just, it is such a spit in the face to British Columbians and coastal First Nations. We've made it abundantly clear over the past weeks and months that there will be no oil pipeline to BC's coasts. And, you know, going behind our back, Carney and Smith signing this MOU, pouring their support behind this project, is an abuse of power. You know, it's completely unacceptable. And, you know, I'm really just reeling with the proposal itself. We're looking at a massive affordability crisis. People are struggling to make ends meet. Our grocery costs are sky high. We're spending half our income on rent. And, you know, the government can't afford to pay for libraries and shelters, but they somehow have billions of dollars for a new oil pipeline that has no global market attached to it. You know, we've tried this with Northern Gateway a decade ago, and that project was canceled, Enbridge pulled its support from that project a decade ago because of coastal First Nations opposition. And their opposition hasn't moved a single inch. And so I don't think tricks Smith has her up her sleeve to think that position will be reversed and that suddenly there'll be a private proponent wanting to take on an economic loser of a project that'll take at least $50 billion to ram through Indigenous territory. But yeah, it's completely ludicrous. And so in a time where, somehow it's easier to socialize a project of that scale than to support communities across BC and across this country with truly sustainable economies that would support the cost of living crisis. You know, it's safe to say I'm banging my head against the wall.
No, yeah,
we're ready to escalate whatever comes our way.
Interesting. Carla, what about you? Like, what's the vibe in Alberta like right now? I imagine maybe mixed, depending on which social circles you're in. But what are your thoughts on all of this, especially in the broader context, I mean, of all the stuff that Alberta has recently been doing to its most vulnerable citizens?
Well, first and foremost, I think as an Albertan on a national podcast, I have to apologize. so sorry. I think we have to reset the counter again. It's still 0 days since Alberta has been a national embarrassment. Just really want to say we're sorry. Oh, geez. I kind of look at this through the lens of like, what is everybody trying to get here? It's obvious for Danielle Smith that she doesn't really care about what Albertans actually want. She is the premier of oil companies. Like, she goes around the world to advocate specifically for the oil industry. She's shut down anything that would look at renewables or green energy. She's put a moratorium on that, saying it's a blight on the environment, but open coal mines, that's okay, on sacred Indigenous territory that's going to poison most of Southern Alberta. That's fine, because that helps what she likes. So she's not even a politician for Albertans. She looks for very specific industries that she backs. So that's very clear. You know, she's kind of gone back to like the original Albertans of just being a boondoggle in a trench coat. I also don't really think Danielle Smith has principles per se. You know, we're kind of all sick of playing the game of like, you take a clip of 2015 Danielle Smith and compare it to 2025 and it says the exact opposite. And then she's got her tinfoil hat era when she was on like these podcasts and like the COVID era. So, I mean, she's really willing to say whatever helps her stay in power. And she thinks that these big corporations are going to do that. But, you know, we're projected at a $6.4 billion deficit in our budget because it's so reliant on oil. And it shows just how bad the math is and unimaginative this is to really serve people. And that's where I think Carney's biggest issue is, because I've tried to put myself in the mindset of like Mark Carney. So I swore at a woman. And then I tried to like figure out like, why would he make this deal? Is he playing 3D chess and he's trying to placate Alberta to defang the conservatives to say, look, I stood up for you on pipelines knowing that it won't work. But then like, is he passing the buck on to British Columbians and Indigenous groups who are actually going to have to stand up and say, no, this isn't? So is he like ducking this to be a coward? And he's trying to play political chess with Danielle Smith so she just stops railing against him all the time? Or I think he spent too long in the boardroom. Like, he thinks too much in the terms of corporations. He thinks too much in the terms of this all masculine community of straight, cis, old white guys who go and drink their scotch back at the club, go to their house, have people clean their thing. Like, this is not a man of the people. This is not somebody who's out there on the streets who understands that a lot of people would like a livable planet in 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, you know, that this is really not serving people. And I think what we're seeing is Emily represents a massive shift in the political landscape that these old dinosaurs are missing, that the politics of usual are over. People are waking up to the radical extremists that are being platformed by conservative parties, and that increasingly people are saying, I'm sick of this centrist BS and I want a progressive future. And that there's so many of us, the NDP, like especially in Alberta with Nenshi, is chasing votes to the right, thinking, well, no one's going to out left us. And I saw Nenshi's tweet today saying, yay, a pipeline. And then a subtweet underneath saying like, well, and we should do other things too. And I really am at odds, because going back to kind of your introduction to me, I love what the NDP is saying about human rights. I love what they're saying about trans rights and about standing up for the rights of workers. But then they go and do these centrist moves like this, and it really makes it kind of like, ugh, I really wish we could have a party that was like wholly progressive and not this, well, we're going to be progressive here, but then, yeah, drill, baby, drill. Let's get oil pipelines. Like, I just think that politicians that are taking a principled stance like Emily, like Zoran Mandami, like Zach Polansky, like, they're showing, hey, if you chase these votes to the right and become a center-center-right party at your own peril.
Emily, I'm curious if you want to dig in a little bit more to that idea. I mean, the one thing that we always hear about these pipeline investments is that, oh, well, you know, this is balancing the economy and like considering the economy. And it's always an economic argument for more extraction. But I don't really see how that entirely makes sense when like a pipeline would cost a ton of money, wouldn't actually be constructed. Generally, they take about a decade, I believe. And so it's like you're talking about extracting oil and getting oil to market in 10 years. So it's not like, you know, Trump will probably not be with us anymore by then. So, you know, I just, there's all these discussions about the strategicness of this, but can you drill down a little bit? Sorry. on, you know, that sort of economic argument and whether you buy it?
Yeah, shocking news. I don't buy it at all.
Really? I thought you would. Just kidding.
But,
sorry.
You know, I will say, what it does feel like a shock doctrine that we're living through right now, because, you know, this kind of goes back to our experience in the spring around the federal election. Mark Carney won on an elbows up election against Donald Trump, and through that period Trump was unleashing a new wave of fossil fever across Canada, where, you know, because I think there's that sort of guttural fear that Canadians felt about, you know, our sovereignty, and some deep historical us versus them dynamics with the US. And I think that unleashes like monkey brain where we say that, you know, we need this economic security, and we need to do what we've always done. And we've always been a rip it and ship it resource economy that has just, you know, relied so heavily on oil and gas. And though, you know, it is a shrinking share of our GDP as a country, and it is, you know, across the board, not an enormous number of jobs. I can speak to BC. Our oil and gas revenue is lower than the money we make off of lottery and casinos. And so, you know, that just goes to show sort of